So here we go. This is Good Charity, Bad Charity. I'm David Prest.
I'm Camilla McGibbon.
I'm Keith Davis.
And I'm Alex Scales.
I'm going to ask everybody a question, which is familiar. What did you have for breakfast? Camilla.
Coffee. I'm quite particular about how it's made.
Yep.
Right.
So it has to be certain beans and they have to be ground in a certain way. And
oh, Lord. You're not coming round my house for coffee.
Wait till we get into the porridge, which is the real excitement. The porridge has blueberries on top.
Oh.
And it's not made with sugar.
Keith, what's your Welsh Borders breakfast like?
Two coffees, one prior to eating and then one during. But it was a blue cheese omelette this morning.
A what? You know, a blue cheese omelette?
Yeah, for breakfast.
Really?
Lordy, that's fancy.
Welsh cheese, I hope.
Welsh blue. There's a couple of nice Welsh blues.
In the east of the country, Alex, what do you have for breakfast?
A good bowl of yoghurt and blueberries, followed with a strong black coffee.
That's good. I mean, you know, I will go for the full works, frankly. Why would anyone not want the sort of, you know, black pudding, two sausages, bacon? The reason we're going on about this is because today we are talking about a campaign and an organisation that is giving breakfast to kids on the basis that it's going to get them going, get them thinking, get their brain working, help their development, etc., etc. And there's an awful lot of new research coming out, and this is all fueled into the Marcus Rashford free school meals debate as well. So it's a very interesting conversation, I think, at the moment.
It is fuel for learning.
Yeah.
And when you think about fuel, I find it always fascinating that people know exactly what they put in their cars, but they're not so exacting about what they put in their mouths. And if you look at it as fuel, then if you haven't got any, you can't run.
And I guess that's why kids who do have a good breakfast actually achieve more, you know, academically.
Our guest today is Elisa Remtula from the organisation Magic Breakfast. She'll be joining us in a second. Alex, I know you're excited about what she's got to say as well.
I'm quite interested in terms of whether this renewed focus on food for children within school, I mean, let's face it, it's been going on for years. Magic Breakfast itself has been around for 20 years. But whether this renewed focus will create competition for funds and for support, or whether it will provide collaborative opportunities to really address and focus on the systemic change that is really needed out there.
Okay, so it's going to be really interesting. We'll sort of pause whilst Elisa enters. Elisa Remtula from Magic Breakfast. You've had an extraordinary career after leaving the civil service. You worked in policy and advocacy for the Stop AIDS Network before joining Magic Breakfast, where you're now the head of policy and campaigns. Magic Breakfast's mission is to ensure that no child in our partner schools is too hungry to learn. They do that by providing healthy breakfast food and expert support to help reach pupils at risk of hunger. The charity currently works with over 1,000 schools in England and Scotland and provides breakfast to around 170,000 children each and every day. So, Elisa, it's very good of you to join us. What is your favourite breakfast?
Well, this is a little indulgent, but during lockdown, I've become very attached to banana pancakes.
Oh, homemade?
Homemade.
Fantastic.
They're quite healthy. They're sort of like oatmeal and banana and yogurt.
Maple syrup?
I am Canadian, so it wouldn't be pancakes without maple syrup.
Oh, my word.
Excellent. Where are you from?
I'm from Toronto.
Go on, Camilla. Tell her where you're from.
Toronto via Kitchener.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm actually from Richmond Hill, now that I know that I'm speaking to a fellow Canadian.
Excellent.
Elisa, tell us, I mean, obviously, so much of the conversation has been around how children are coping with lockdown, clearly having their education disrupted quite spectacularly in some cases. How have you as an organisation been responding to the needs?
So for us as Magic Breakfast, we had traditionally delivered breakfast food to schools, and that's where children were enjoying their healthy breakfast. Mm. And so when schools closed more than a year ago now, it was really challenging for us to sort of adapt overnight and figure out how we were going to get food to children, even when they weren't at school. And so what we did sort of over a period of 48 hours, basically, changed our entire delivery model. We started delivering take-home breakfast packs instead, and these contained sort of 2 weeks' worth of breakfast for children. And then we would deliver those to schools, and the schools would then arrange for parents to come and collect in a socially distanced way. Or in some cases, teachers were loading up vans and driving around all of their pupils' homes to check in on their children. Yeah, some really amazing stories of teachers really going above and beyond.
And just give us a sense of why it is that the breakfast meal in particular is so important. I mean, I know there's been a lot of research been done about the value of the breakfast meal.
I think the strongest research is around the impact on children's academic attainment. So, for example, a child that attends a school with a magic breakfast, school breakfast provision, makes 2 months additional academic progress during a year compared to a child who goes to a school without a magic breakfast. There's also some really strong research showing that children who access a breakfast achieve higher results at GCSEs, and also some fantastic studies showing a link between children who eat breakfast being less likely to be overweight or obese. So there are a ton of benefits, and we recently did some research to kind of map out what that means for children's long-term life chances, and found that children's earnings go up later on in life, and that basically for every £1 you invest in breakfast now, you generate £50 in long-term economic benefits because of a child's higher lifetime earnings.
Interesting.
And so give us a snapshot of the organisation, how it works, how it's funded, how you distribute, and the size of the job that you're doing.
So as an organisation, I think we've grown to about 70 members of staff during COVID. We have a few different sort of teams and objectives. We have a whole team of staff that look after the schools that we partner with, and they work with the schools to make sure that breakfast is delivered in a way that doesn't create stigma, and to make sure that the food provided is of a very high quality. Then we have my team. We work on campaigning for long-term change. We know that it's not just the role of a charity to ensure that no child's too hungry to learn. And in the long run, we think more government investment and policy change is needed to kind of accomplish our objectives. And then we have a brilliant fundraising team that go out and make sure that we're actually able to do all the things we need to do. And in terms of who we're funded by, it's really a mix. Lots of corporate partners, lots of partners from the food industry in particular. We also have substantial support from trusts and foundations, as well as individual givers, and that kind of skyrocketed during COVID-19.
Yeah. Camilla?
I really like the fact that you give breakfast to whole classes of students so that nobody feels that there's a stigma.
Yeah, so I think we believe that a universal approach is very important. We only work with schools with high levels of disadvantage. So once a school has become eligible for our support, we really encourage that kind of universal offer. So breakfast should be available to any child who wants to access it. And there's no sort of restrictions in terms of eligibility. And what a lot of schools are doing nowadays is they'll do something like a sit down before school breakfast club and invite, let's say, 30 or 40 children to attend. But then they'll also do something like classroom provision or playground provision so that every child who enters the school or sits down at a desk has the option to access breakfast if they want it.
Do you think that there is still surprise that there are people going to school who are hungry?
I think it depends on who you talk to. So I meet with lots of MPs from all political parties, some of whom have a really hard time kind of conceptualizing and understanding the level of hunger that exists in our society. But then we've recently recruited a group of 10 youth campaigners with lived experiences of food insecurity, and they've grown up in the communities that we serve as Magic Breakfast. And, you know, they have no doubt in their mind what an issue hunger is and how much it affects their communities.
Yeah.
I'm intrigued by the response of MPs. Are some of them thinking, well, breakfast comes on a silver salver and it's usually kedgeree or what?
You get all types of responses. There are many MPs themselves that have been on free school meals and have grown up without support. You also get MPs who ask questions, and it's not just MPs, to be fair, who ask questions about why the parents aren't doing this for the children themselves. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes I find that difficult to explain the kind of complexity of family life for certain groups, because there's something in the fact that many families don't have enough money to put food on the table. But it's also about explaining those more complex factors around, you know, do you have the time? Are you well and able to get out of bed in the morning? Are you working a double night shift? It's a lot more complex than some people might think. One thing I've found is that when MPs come to visit a breakfast club and sit down with children from their constituency and eat breakfast with them, I found that to be very transformational for MPs. And I've noticed a real kind of shift in the relationship we have with them after that.
Can I just pick up on the point around inclusion and accessibility? Do the schools approach you, or does your school team play a role in really identifying those communities that would most benefit from what you're able to provide? I only ask because we all know that there are many communities who perhaps aren't as aware as others in terms of the support that is available.
Yep. So in general, schools will fill out an expression of interest and submit that to us. And if they meet our eligibility requirements and we have funding available, we'll go back to them. But when we have delivered government contracts, or we've been delivering a government contract for the past sort of 3 years now, because we had a big pot of money that was available all at one go, we wrote to all the schools that were eligible for funding to make them aware of the opportunity. So it's a bit of both, but you're right, it does rely on, you know, that head teacher who's scouring the internet for opportunities for their school, and not all head teachers or not all teaching staff are in a place to do that, given everything else they're juggling.
You said in the brief that I got that there were a number of families who couldn't get their children to school for breakfast at school. You've obviously learnt through COVID that actually delivering works quite well as well. Do you have a view about going forward then, saying what we should have is a mix? We should actually deliver at home for those that are challenged to get in first thing in the morning for whatever reason, as well as running the breakfast clubs?
I think there are so many benefits of children having breakfast at school in terms of that kind of social aspect and them enjoying breakfast with their friends, and also having that chance to speak to an adult and maybe digest things that have happened at home the night before and kind of process things. But I think different strategies work in different communities. And for example, one thing we've noticed during COVID is that for secondary schools, it's particularly difficult to get a teenager out of bed and to a before school breakfast club. And stigma is more of an issue at secondary school level because it's not very cool to be eating your free school breakfast. And we saw a huge spike in demand from our secondary schools because more children were accessing the breakfast when it was delivered to them. So I think there has to be space for both options. And certainly the approaches that we've developed during COVID-19, we will use going forward. So for example, we've decided we are now in a position to deliver over the holidays through take-home breakfast packs when they're not in school.
And interestingly, you've done a deal with Amazon, delivering breakfasts on their delivery network. But you also had an extraordinary success in a way, in that your Christmas appeal during COVID had an extraordinary response, far, far greater than you'd expected.
Yes. Our Keeping Breakfast Going campaign, which we launched more or less as the COVID-19 pandemic took hold, raised over £1 million, which was just for us, it's huge. Our yearly turnover normally is around £3 million. So to have an extra million sort of flowing in almost overnight was extraordinary. At a time when so many individuals were struggling and were losing their jobs and being furloughed, amazing to see that public response come through. And can't thank all of those individual supporters enough.
And how much of that do you think is about the Marcus Rashford effect, let's call it that? I mean, just give us a sense of how he has lit the blue touch paper.
I was speaking to our community fundraising manager about this yesterday, and she was saying she could see a spike in donations corresponding to days when he was speaking out about these issues.
Yeah.
And I think I need to create an impact report and send it to him and tell him, you know, the impact he's had on us as an individual charity. It's been extraordinary. I mean, I haven't worked on food insecurity for too long, but even I can feel the difference in the way people are paying attention and the appetite in the media for covering stories about the issues that we work on has just drastically risen. I think Marcus Rashford's made a fantastic and great difference. And what's been most powerful is that he is a young person with lived experiences of food insecurity himself. And so he's able to speak with authenticity and credibility. And he's also worked in partnership with charities. So he hasn't just gone off and developed some recommendations out of the blue. He's partnered and listened and tried to amplify what we were already doing. You know, not all celebrities kind of take that approach. And so I think we want to hold on to him and sort of harness him to do more things with.
Your lived experience, students that are speaking for you, you talk about those as future campaigners, which made me wonder, how do they stand out? I mean, when you're looking for future campaigners, what is it that you see?
That's a really interesting question, because we were trying to recruit young people from diverse backgrounds, and we didn't want to set criteria that would discount some experiences exactly. that maybe traditional recruitment practices would. So we were recruited based on values, things like resilience, openness to meeting new people, and passion. One of the questions we asked them on the application form was, if you met Boris Johnson, what are the three things you'd say to him? And honestly, some of their answers were just communicated with so much originality. You know, it wasn't like I would endorse the three recommendations from the National Food Strategy. It was, I would ask him if he feels it's as important for me to eat as it is for him.
Great, wow. Great.
Hard hitting.
That's yeah. fantastic.
I guess there were some you couldn't print either.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just to go back to the phenomenal profile raising that has been achieved by Marcus Rashford, as that continues, do you think that will provide more competition for you to achieve funding or more collaborative working opportunities as there becomes more familiarity and knowledge about the smaller community-led organisations that perhaps are also trying to address these issues?
Sure. I think it hasn't created any competition at a funding level. If anything, it's opened up funding opportunities and so far been like a net positive in terms of the funding available. I think it has brought forward collaboration because it's brought a lot of people out of the woodwork that were perhaps working on similar things, but not necessarily talking to each other. For example, Marcus Rashford has established his business task force. There's now a group of civil society organizations that sort of sits beneath that and liaises with the task force, and that's coordinated by the Food Foundation. And it's one of the most effective kind of civil society coordination bodies that I've been a part of. And I'm sure you guys must hear, you know, sometimes charities work well together and sometimes it's just people sitting in a room talking to each other and then nothing ever happens.
Nothing happens.
So I think one yes. of the things that's been great about this Food Foundation coordinated coalition is it's been very action oriented. And I felt like we've built new partnerships and met new people and it's actually resulted in tangible outcomes.
You're listening to Good Charity, Bad Charity. Our guest today is Elisa Ramtula, who's head of policy and campaigns at Magic Breakfast. And I'm going to ask the question which any parent of a six-year-old and a four-year-old will ask you, I'm sure. When I make my packed lunches for the children at breakfast time, at home time, they come back with their little packed lunch bag and they haven't eaten this time. They've changed their mind about whether they like these breakfast bars or whether they want those. Kids can be picky buggers. How on earth do you cope with that in the provision of magic breakfasts?
Well, we offer a range of products, so hopefully there's something for everyone. We offer low-sugar cereals, oatmeal, bagels, beans, and juice that's diluted. We have tried and sort of tested what works with kids, you know, over the past 20 years. And while we want to kind of improve the offer of breakfast to children and make it more and more nutritious, you're right, we also have to think about what they're actually going to eat. So I think we trialed eggs a few years back and none of the kids wanted eggs and it was too difficult to make in school. You have to have that dose of practicality of what's actually going to work for kids.
David, all I will say is you wait till they get to young adults and you wish you could still do their packed lunch for them, mate, I tell you.
So just going back, talking about the lobbying work that you do, because earlier in the year you were part of a group of people who are disappointed about the lack of provision for free school meals, whether that's breakfast or lunches, in the budget. And then miraculously, the Department of Education announces a tender worth 24 million quid to get to 2,500 schools. Now, you're not going for that tender process. Just flesh out what your stance is at the moment.
So first of all, what was announced, the 24 million, although we really welcome any funding announced for school breakfast and we recognize the challenging context governments operating within, it falls short of what we were campaigning for. And when you talk about that tender reaching 2,500 schools, the government's own eligibility criteria for this program shows that there are 8,700 schools that could benefit right. from the provision. But the reason that we've decided not to enter a bid is not because of the scale of funding. It's because of the shape and scope of the tender. So at the moment, the way the government funds school breakfast, they fund the food being delivered, but then they also fund expert advice and support to schools, which is very fundamental to our model to make sure the food reaches the right children. In this new tender, they're just funding food. And so it is literally a delivery of food to schools' yeah. doors kind of program. And we felt there wasn't sufficient alignment with our charitable mission
Do you think by not tendering for that opportunity, it might diminish your seat at the influencing table, if I can put it like that? Because, you know, obviously a lot of contracts, charities are in two minds in terms of whether to take them up. They are notoriously skinny in very many ways, but some organisations have evidence that it does provide them with an enhanced credibility that perhaps then opens up other funding opportunities.
We've considered that. But I think we're looking forward to re-establishing a new relationship with the Department for Education on different footing, and a more strategic relationship that helps us further our charitable purpose. And I will say that officials at the DfE are incredibly constructive and open to dialogue. And I think that going forward, when we are not government delivery partners, we'll have more space to be more vocal about what we see as the gaps and what the government is doing.
Do you get the sense that politicians are being honest with people? Are they saying this is for reasons of poverty, or are they saying this is for other things?
Well, one of the things that really concerned me about the tender specification that was launched was that in the hundreds of pages of documentation, the word hunger wasn't used once.
And really?
The words used instead are about social mobility, academic attainment, reducing obesity. Those are all goals, but to achieve those goals, the food has to reach the children that would have gone without otherwise. I've been considering over, you know, the last few weeks as Magic Breakfast, what's our role here? And I think it is to inject hunger back into the discussion.
Just turning back to lived experience and, you know, loving the idea in terms of your youth campaigners, how much have you carried that lived experience through to the governance of the organisation? Do you have those with lived experience on your board?
So, very interesting question, because we are getting the youth campaigners onto our committees and board, because at the moment we do not have people with lived experiences in our governance structures. And to make that involvement meaningful and not just kind of a tokenistic, you know, nod to the idea of having those people in the organization, they have to be involved in the decision-making structures. And what's been interesting as we've like scoped this piece of work out is we've had to make a lot of adaptations to our processes and to how our governance structures work, but they've all been good adaptations that I think we should have made either way in terms of, you know, supporting people to engage constructively and meaningfully.
How do you think that changes the organisation, though, if you do have that embedded experience?
I think with the youth campaigners specifically, the kind of brief they've been giving is to make sure that we keep our eyes on the things that matter to young people. Because, you know, as an organisation working with children and young people, one of our biggest values is to be child-centred. And so what does that mean? How do a group of kind of 10 people who perhaps, you know, haven't been to school in a long time, how do you keep child-centred when you're not connected to that community? I will say on our board, we have one head teacher from a Magic Breakfast supported school, and she does a fantastic job of reminding us what's actually going on in the school and what her day-to-day reality is and making sure the decisions we make are in line with that.
But how are you going to get past with young people the argument that always comes up with any youth charity, that no young person wants to sit in a 2-hour board meeting and discuss the accounts? Because that's what they're going to have to do if you are bringing them at trustee level.
I actually disagree. I think there are young people who are willing to sit in a 2-hour meeting and go over the accounts. And many of the young people that we've recruited are excited about becoming youth advisors to the board, but they need training and support. So they're going through a 3-month period of training right now to upskill on campaigning and advocacy, but also to get to grips with kind of the basics of being a young trustee. In terms of the legal responsibilities, because our youth campaigners, many of them are below 18, they won't have full legal responsibility as trustees. And the way we're describing it is youth advisors to the board.
Right. What do you see at the moment then? Because obviously we're looking for people to vision forward as well. What's the biggest challenges going forward for you in the next 5 years then?
I think one will be sustaining our fundraising at the absolutely high levels that it's skyrocketed to during COVID-19, because we've almost set ourselves this expectation of what we now can bring in, and then maintaining that and converting some of the, not emergency response, but into long-term sustainable support. I think that will take a lot of kind of stewardship. The other challenge will be working alongside a new delivery partner in the school breakfast landscape. I mean, someone is going to get the 24 million. So working out how we work alongside them and how we make sure that whoever delivers it does it as well as possible.
Does the 5-year strategy, Elisa, encompass, we have achieved everything we want to achieve and therefore we cease to exist as a charity.
So when I talk about the long-term solution to classroom hunger and the need for government funding and legislation, we're quite comfortable with the idea that we might not be needed. Truthfully, I don't see it happening in the next 5 years. I hope within the next sort of 10. I'm just sort of thinking about, you know, where we are in the election cycle, when legislation could come into place, and all the other bits and bobs that would need to go alongside that. And I'm personally still not convinced that we have a majority cross-party consensus for this yet, or that the government support this in the way that they would need to for us not to exist.
We're asking everybody this question during this particular period, but, you know, the challenges of leadership during COVID have probably strained every sinew of people in organizations and charities. How has it been for you?
It's been really challenging, but I think what I've learned from it personally as a leader is you can't always stick to your policy. In COVID, it's been, you know, what is a reasonable solution that will keep everyone safe, that we can afford, that makes sense at this point in time? We've thrown a lot of our rules out of the window and just been like, what's going to be reasonable for people right now?
Anything that you've adopted during the period that you found is an effective way of working that perhaps you might want to continue post-COVID?
It's not a way of working, but one big shift in our organization has been recognizing that we will deliver over the holidays and that hunger doesn't disappear during the holidays, and neither should we.
Brilliant. I think we're done. That's been fantastic.
Yeah.
Great.
Bye. Thanks for now.
Bye.
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 So Elisa has left us. We can have our post-match discussion. Camilla, Keith, Alex, what do we think?
Really dynamic woman. Makes you feel that the charity is incredibly dynamic. Love the fact that education is a huge part of what they do. It's not just we give breakfast in schools, but we are educating people to a better diet. And then, gosh, they're going to be the campaigners of the future because this is part of the deal as well. And I think for the future of civic society, which is what we're all about, this is a huge, huge bonus.
I thought she was fantastic in the way that she was prepared to be open and honest with us about challenges. You know, how the hell do you maintain the funding you've got, the need to work alongside other charities and other providers? And again, this bit that she said within COVID, this agile management, where they've had to say, you know, we're making changes on the hoof, but that's what we've got to do and learn from them.
Yeah.
For me, I absolutely agree, Camilla. I mean, you know, the organisation has been around for over 20 years, but it came across as really dynamic and progressive and pushing boundaries and still very much moving forward in its own journey. I think she articulated really well the balancing of highly emotive messaging, which obviously the word, you know, children who are hungry evokes, versus creating that narrative about the longer term impact, the importance to education, to health, to the wider economy, which I could see we all sort of sat up when she gave that £1 invested, produced £50 ultimately in terms of lifetime earnings from the children that are able to access these breakfasts.
Well, when she talked about instructing the students who were going to be campaigning, and the exam question was, what three things would you tell Boris Johnson? And that's one of those things, Alex, you know, the 1 to 50. He would stop in the elevator at that point and say, I think I get it.
Yeah. I thought it was a particularly impressive piece of grilling, Camilla, about whether a 14-year-old can read a balance sheet. But at the same time, she had a very good articulation of, you know, why it's going to have an impact on the organisation and how it keeps it grounded.
Yeah, but she also, David, she said, they're an advisory group.
Yeah.
That is not the same as them sitting on the board.
Yeah.
And that is a huge issue when you go to the lived experience. We can all have an advisory group.
Yeah.
But what we need to know is, are they listening or are they saying, well, we have an advisory group with lived experience. That's very nice. They can sit over here in the corner.
Absolutely. And there's so much learning coming through. And you know, one would hope with this organisation that they take it a few steps further and enable those with lived experience in due course to become, you know, full trustees, full board members. But also, you know, Camilla, you're absolutely right in terms of, you know, your question around scrutinising a balance sheet. But what is coming through from those who are making a success of having a lived experience presence is that actually the way the organisational governance is carried out has to change as well. So it could be, instead of being presented with a full balance sheet, it could be a dashboard, you know, red, amber, green, to enable them to be a full contributor to the governance as opposed to just sitting on the sideline.
Should every charity be doing this, or is there specific types of charities where it works well, others where it won't work well?
It's very much a trend at the moment. There's insufficient evidence being shared at the moment in terms of the benefits, but anecdotally, people who get it to work successfully are absolute fans of it and think that it brings them much closer to the beneficiaries and for them to be able to shape a solution to the need that's being presented.
Yeah, but if you look at it from, say, an existing board perspective, the issue that I have with many boards is that the trustee needs to be trained up to go out and talk to all the people that are involved. So I've visited endless community centres and talked to endless kids. I don't have lived experience just because I'm not of that generation anymore. But that doesn't mean I can't find out.
Yeah.
I personally think that the lived experience thing, hugely valuable. Trustees need to go out and get some.
Yeah. And I think you're right. And I think we're in a situation at the moment where I know some of the charities where I'm working with, refugees and travellers themselves have been put on the boards, and they find they can't handle that because they're getting criticised by their own colleagues, not the charity, but the refugees and that they live with, for being on there. It's a really hard role.
Yeah, it's certainly not easy. Do share your experiences via our Centre for Charity Effectiveness website. Okay. We launched a number of new pages just this week, specifically on lived experience, because everything that we're hearing points to it as being a really difficult area for everything that Camilla and Keith have mentioned.
I think we're done, aren't we? You've been listening to Good Charity, Bad Charity, and more cracking episodes at goodcharitybadcharity.com. Look us up on Twitter at GCBC Podcast. Our thanks to Dan Hardoon of Woodland Productions, the Centre for Charity Effectiveness. Don't forget to check out that feedback form for lived experience on their website. And of course, we thank the City Brief Trust, who've been underwriting our activities for a while. Till the next time, goodbye.